This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
I'm very pleased to have been asked by the Lannan Foundation to introduce B.H. Fairchild for tonight's reading. Mr. Fairchild and I have, on several occasions, read at each other's campuses, and thus we belong to that ever-growing poetic fraternity known as the Mutual Introduction Society, which is not necessarily to be confused with the Mutual Admiration Society. In this case, I can assure you that the admiration flows in at least one direction, and that direction is away from me and toward him. He is a poet whose work I unreservedly admire. However, before I can introduce B.H. Fairchild, I must tell you about another Fairchild, one whom I have known for over 30 years. In 1973, I was hired at Southwest Texas State University as what was known as an adjunct instructor of English. There were six or seven of us hired that fall, and all fresh out of grad school and on contracts that stipulated that we would be terminated at the end of 3 years. Thus, we soon began to call ourselves terminal instructors of English. Our generally paranoid state wasn't helped much by the fact that at any given moment, one senior faculty member seemed to be plotting the murder of another. So our group stayed pretty tight, bonding like a school of mullet being circled by sharks. One of us was a newly minted PhD from the University of Tulsa, Pete Fairchild. For two of those years, Pete, his wife Patty, their young son Paul, and their daughter-to-be, Sarah, were my neighbors living only a block away. I knew Pete then as a William Blake scholar who loved beer, motorcycles, and movies, good or bad. One of the most brilliant pieces of academic exegesis I have ever read was Pete Fairchild's application of the four Zoas of William Blake's poetry to the four male leads in George Lucas's film American Graffiti. I had a lot of respect for Pete Fairchild's originality, which greatly increased one Sunday afternoon when I found him at his kitchen table reading Blake while drinking a can of pearl beer and eating a pickled pig's foot. I had seen pickled pig's feet in grocery stores, but I had never seen somebody actually eat one. This, I thought, is a man of many original qualities. After our 3 years passed and we terminal instructors were duly terminated, but went on luckily to other teaching jobs, Pete and I stayed in touch, but it wasn't until the early 1980s that I began to see poems, good poems, in journals written by one B.H. Fairchild. In the years of our acquaintance, I can't recall Pete's ever having mentioned that he wrote poetry. He certainly didn't show me any of it. Over the years, B.H.'s productivity increased. Early chapbooks were followed by The Arrival of the Future in 1985, and then by Local Knowledge, which was published as part of the Quarterly Review of Literature's Poetry Series. I was impressed that Pete, or B.H., was doing such great work, but I must admit that these early books gave me no indication of what was to come when he asked me to write a blurb for a new collection to be published by Alice James Books. The manuscript I received was titled The Art of the Lathe, and I must say that it knocked my socks off. About that book, I said in part, James Joyce's Stephen Dedalus spoke of forging the conscience of his race in the smithy of his soul. In the dusty light of a Kansas machine shop, B.H. Fairchild has performed similar magic. When the book won a prize, I was very happy for Pete, and it kept on winning prizes. Among them, all in 1999, the William Carlos Williams Award, the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, the California Book Award, the Natalie Ornish Book Poetry Award, and the Penn Center USA West Poetry Award. And his next book, Early Occult Memory Systems of the Lower Midwest, topped even that list, winning the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Rebecca Johnson Bobbitt National Prize from the Library of Congress, and the Aiken Taylor Award for Modern Poetry from the University of the South. B.H. Fairchild has had the kind of success that most poets only dream of. And it is even more remarkable when we consider that most of it came after his 50th birthday, and that all of his books, with the exception of the most recent, were published as a result of open manuscript competitions. I stand in awe of B.H. Fairchild's accomplishments, and often get the impression that Pete Fairchild does as well. How such a fine, somewhat diffident academic and scholar managed to hide such a luminous candle under the scholar's bushel for so long remains a mystery to me. But it does seem utterly right that I loved and admired Pete Fairchild for some years before I came to love and admire the poetry of B.H. Fairchild. It is my great pleasure to introduce both of them to you on this occasion.
Well, this takes some of the nervousness off. I can see no one at all. I want to thank the Lannan Foundation for inviting me to give this reading. I also want to thank the Lannan Foundation very, very much for giving me a residence in Marfa, Texas for a month, where I wrote, I got a lot of writing done, which I thought was some of my best work. And I'm going to read a couple of those poems this evening. It's great to be in Santa Fe. My father was in New Mexico building roads for the Bureau of Indian Affairs back during the Depression. So reading poems is not like building roads, but we'll see where it takes us anyway. First poem is one of the poems I wrote in my Marfa residency. And it has to do with the scariest guy I ever worked with. I practically grew up in a machine shop that was run by my father in a small town in Kansas, and it was on Highway 54, which was the main north-south route down to what was then Route 66. So there were a lot of hitchhikers along the highway, and they would sometimes come in and ask for temporary work, and he would hire them for a couple of weeks. And so this one fellow that he hired, and of course I was the one who always worked with them, and this one fellow that he hired, who I wound up calling the gray man, I'm quite sure, certain he was Anglo, but he looked as if he had spent his entire life in a closet or a box somewhere. He was just really scary. The gray man. We were cutting weeds and sunflowers on the shoulder, the gray man and I. Red dust coiling up around us, muddying our sweat-smeared mugs, clogging our hair, the iron heel of an August Kansas sun pushing down on the sides we raise against it and swing down in an almost homicidal rage and drunken weariness. And I keep my distance. He's a new hire just off the highway, a hitchhiker sick to death of hunger, the cruelties of the road, and our boss hates poverty just enough to hire it, even this old man. A dead, leaden pall upon his skin, so vile it makes you pull away. The gray trousers and state-issue black prison boots, the bloodless, grim, unmoving lips, and the eyes set in concrete. Dark hallways that lead to darker rooms down somewhere in the basement of the soul's despair. 2 weeks. He hasn't said a word. He's a goddamn ghost, I tell my father. Light flashes from his scythe as he decapitates big clumps of yellow blooms, a flailing, brutal war against the lords of labor, I suppose, against the state, the world, himself, who knows? When we break, I watch the canteen's water bleed from the corners of his mouth, a spreading wound across his shirt, the way he spits into the swollen pile of bluestem and rank bindweed as if he hates it and everything that grows, a hatred that has roots and thickens, twisting, snarled around itself. A lizard wanders into sunlight and he hacks at it, chopping clods until dust clouds rise like mist around him. And then he speaks. In a kind of shattering of glass cutting through the hot wind's sigh, the fear. Love thine enemy. He says it to the weeds, or maybe what they stand for. Then, knees buckling, with a rasping, gutted sob as if drowning in that slough of dirty air, he begins, trembling, to cry. I was just a boy. The plains wind leaned against the uncut weeds. High wires hummed with human voices in their travail. And the highway I had worked but never traveled lay across the fields and vanished in that distant gray where day meets night. Well, in this little Kansas town where I grew up, unfortunately, and I don't like to say bad things about the place I grew up, but unfortunately, the thing I remember most about the place was the incredible boredom. And it reached the point where in high school, boys driven crazy with boredom were engaged in a really crazy activity. In those days, boys were as mechanically gifted as I think they are with, well, all young people, boys and girls, are with computers these days. And, you know, you could go out to the junkyard and get an old wreck and maybe spend $20 on parts and work on it a couple of nights until you could at least get it to go out on the highway at the rate of 60 or 70 miles an hour. And what was happening is they were doing that, and they'd get out there, and by the way, this was before seatbelts, and he'd get it up to a pretty high speed, and then the driver would pop the wheel real fast and make the car roll. It got so bad that they were beginning to compete with each other to see who could make the car roll the most times. And so I knew that someday I would write a poem about this, and so I did. I'm one of those poets who actually writes poems to be understood, as radical as radical as that may sound. So, so there's some things I want to explain to you before I start. Caliche. Caliche is a white road covering that is used in that part of the country. Red man refers to red man chewing tobacco. Coronado. Coronado is supposed to have come that far north in his explorations. At least that's the myth that is circulated by towns looking for tourists out there. There are four boys here who are going out to roll a car for the first time. One of them really stands out, and that is Travis Doyle, who has a very different attitude toward the car rolling than they do. And also in the narrator. The narrator's speech is larded with biblical phrases here and there, which at that time in that part of the country would not be have been unusual, the way even these days in the Deep South it's not unusual. So that's just how he talks. The poem is called Rave On, which is the old Buddy Holly song. And the epigraph is the last line from a great poem by James Dickey called Cherry Log Road. wild to be wreckage forever. Rave on. Oh, there's a pause that comes in this poem, and the poem's not over, but there has to be a pause, and then I begin reading again. Rumbling over Caliche with a busted muffler, radio blasting Buddy Holly over Baptist wheat fields, Travis screaming out, "Prepare ye the way of the Lord," at jackrabbits skittering beneath our headlights, the Messiah coming to Kansas in a flathead Ford with bad plates, the whole high plains holding its breath, night is fast upon us low, and these the days of our youth, and we were hell on wheels, or thought we were. Boredom grows thick as maize in Kansas, heavy as drill pipe littering the racks of oil rigs where in summer boys roust about or work on combine crews north as far as Canada. The ones left back in town begin to die, dragging Main Street shit-faced on 3-2 beer and banging on the whorehouse door in Garden City where the ancient madam laughed and turned us down since we were only boys and she knew our fathers. We sat out front, spitting red men, and scanned a landscape flat as Dresden. Me, Mike Luckinbill, Billy Hines, and Travis Doyle, who sang, "I'm gonna live fast, love hard, and die young." We had eaten all the life there was in Seward County, but hungry still, hauled ass to old Arcalin, the ghost town on the Cimarron, that lay in half shadow and a scattering of starlight. And its stillness was a kind of death, the last breath of whatever in our lives was ending. We had drunk there and tossed our bottles at the walls and pissed great arcs into the Kansas earth where the dust groweth hard and the clods cleave fast together, yea, where night yawns above the river in its long dark dream, above haggard branches of mesquite, chicken hawks scudding into the tree line, and moon glitter on Caliche, like the silver plates of Coronado's treasure buried all these years, but the absence of treasure, absence of whatever would return the world to the strangeness that as children we embraced and recognized as life. Rave on. Cars are cheap at Roman Salvage, strewn along the fence out back where cattle graze and chew rotting fabric from the seats. $20 for spare parts in the night in the garage can make them run as far as death and stupidity required. On Johnson Road, where 2 miles of low shoulders and no fence line would take you up to 60, say, and when you flip the wheel clockwise, you are there rolling in the belly of the whale, belly of hell, and your soul fainteth within you, for we had seen it done by Big Ed Ravenscroft, who said you would go in a boy and come out a man. And so we headed back through town where the marquee of the plaza flashed Creature from the Black Lagoon in storefront windows, and the snack shack where we had spent our lives was shutting down, and we sang Rave On, It's a Crazy Feeling, out into the night that loomed now like a darkened church, and sang loud and louder still, for we were sore afraid. Coming up out of the long tunnel of cottonwoods that opens onto Johnson Road, Travis, with his foot stuck deep into the soul of that old Ford, "Come on, Bubba, come on," beating the dash with his fist, hair flaming back in the wind, and eyes lit up by some fire in his head that I had never seen. And Mike, Iron Mike, sitting tall in back with Billy, who would pick a fight with anything that moved, but now hunched over, mumbling something like a prayer, as the Ford lurched on, spitting and coughing, but then smoothing out suddenly fast, and the fence line quitting so it was open field. Then, I think, we were butt deep in regret and a rush of remembering whatever we would leave behind. Samantha Dobbins, smelling like fresh laundry, light from the movies spilling down her long blonde hair. Trout leaping all silver and pink from Black Bear Creek. The hand of my mother, I confess, passing gentle across my face at night when I was a child. Oh, yes, it was all good now. And too late, trees blurring past and Travis wild popping the wheel. Oh, too late, and the waters pass over us, the air thick as mud slams against our chests. Though turning now, the car in its slow turning seems almost graceful, the frame in agony like some huge animal groaning. And when the wheels leave the ground, the engine cuts loose with a wail thin and ragged as a bandsaw cutting tin. And we are drowning, breathless, heads jammed against our knees. And it's a thick, swirling, purple nightmare we cannot wake up from, for the world is turning too. And I hear Billy screaming, and then the whomp, sick crunch of glass and metal, whomp, again, back window popping loose and glass exploding, someone crying out, tink, tink of iron on iron overhead, and then at last it's over and the quiet comes. Oh, so quiet. Somewhere the creak and grind of a pumping unit. Crickets. The tall grass sifting the wind in a mass of whispers that I know I'll be hearing when I die. And so we crawled trembling from doors and windows, born out of rage and boredom, into weed-choked fields barren as Golgotha. Blood raked the side of Travis's face, grinning rapt, ecstatic. Mike's arm was hanging down like a broken curtain rod. Billy kneeled, stunned, listening as we all did to the rustling silence and the spinning wheels and their sad, manic song as the Ford's high beams hurled their cross poles of light forever out into the deep and future darkness. Rave on. Well, I survived. We all did. And then came the long surrender. The long, slow drifting down like young hawks riding on the purest, thinnest air, the very palm of God holding them aloft so close to something hidden there. And then the letting go, the fluttering descent, claws spread wide against the world, and we become, at last, our fathers, and do not know ourselves, and therefore no longer know each other. Mike Luck and Bill ran a Texaco in town for years. Billy Hines survived a cruel divorce, remarried, and then took to drink. But finally, last week, I found this house in Arizona where the brothers take new names and keep a vow of silence and make a quiet place for any weary or lost passenger of earth whose unquiet life has brought him there. And so, after Vespers, I sat across the table from men who had not surrendered to the world. And one of them looked at me and looked into me. And I am telling you, there was a fire in his head, and his eyes were coming fast down a caliche road. And I knew this man, and his name was Travis Doyle. The next poem I want to read is actually very, very factual. The title of it is Moses Yellow Horse is Throwing Water Balloons from the Hotel Roosevelt. And it has to do with the terrible sort of fate of a great, great baseball player who was treated badly when he was taken into the big leagues, Pittsburgh Pirates, when he was 18 years old. Now, I have an uncle by marriage who is Navajo, so I understand the political incorrectness of connecting Native Americans with drinking, but I hope you will understand in the poem that the point of this is what brought that about. And there are many things I have to explain here. I wrote this poem at Bellagio, a place that the Rockefeller Foundation has for writers who would otherwise never, ever be able to go to Lake Como in Italy. And it's on Lake Como, and it's surrounded by these just absolutely lavish villas, which I understand were mostly built in the past by wealthy Romans for their mistresses. Another thing is you need to know that my father and his brothers were sort of local legends in the part of Oklahoma where they grew up, and local legends as baseball players. And their pitcher was this 18-year-old Pawnee Indian named, what I think of as the wonderful name of Moses Yellow Horse. And he was picked up very, he was just amazing, and he was signed by the Pittsburgh Pirates. And but his career only lasted for a year and a half. I think it was 1920, 1921. Because he started misbehaving. Well, they were listing him on the program as Chief Yellow Horse. So you can see how they were using him. He had a great fastball, and if they had been more interested in him as a pitcher than as some kind of a show, they could have taught him the other pitches that he needed to know in order to have a career in the big leagues. There's a reference to Ty Cobb here, who was arguably the greatest hitter ever in Major League Baseball, but who is almost equally well known as being a profound racist. Also, my grandfather's expectations for my father and his brothers was that they would play big league baseball. If you came from a working class family, then your father didn't want you to grow up to be a lawyer or a doctor. He wanted you to grow up to play big league baseball. And he thought if Moses Yellow Horse could do it, then surely they could do it. Moses Yellow Horse is throwing water balloons from the Hotel Roosevelt. The combed lawn of the Villa Carlotta cools the bare feet of my aesthetic friend, cooing, beautiful, so beautiful, a dream. Beneath the fat leaves of catalpa trees and my Marxist friend, ironic, mordant, groans, ah yes, indeed, how beautifully the rich lie down upon the backs of the poor. But I am somewhere else. An empty field near Black Bear Creek in western Oklahoma, brought there by that ancient word, dream. My father saying, you had the dream, horse. And two men toss a baseball back and forth as the sun dissolves behind the pearl gray strands of a cirrus and the frayed flaming branches along the creek so that the men too seem to be on fire. And the other one, a tall Pawnee named Moses Yellow Horse, drops his glove. But I wasn't a man there. And there, I know, is Pittsburgh. And man means something more like human. For as a boy, I had heard this story many times, beginning always, he was the fastest I ever caught. The fastest, I think, there ever was. And I was stunned, because for a boy in America, to be the fastest was to be a god. And now my father and his brothers move behind a scrim of dust in a fallow wheat field, a blanket stretched between two posts to make a backstop, a stand of maize to mark the outfield wall, while their father watches, if an Indian can make it, then so by God can they. And so it goes, this story of failure in America. Icarus unwarned, strapped with its father's wings. My father, one winter morning, patching the drive line of an old Ford tractor with a strand of baling wire, blood popping out along his knuckles, and then in fury, turning to his father, I'm not good enough. I'll never get there. And I'm sorry. I'm goddamn sorry. While Moses Yellow Horse is drunk again, and throwing water balloons from the Hotel Roosevelt, because now he is Chief Yellow Horse. And even though in a feat of almost angelic beauty, he struck out Gehrig, Ruth, and Lazare with 9 straight fastballs, something isn't right. So one day he throws a head ball at Ty Cobb, then tells my father he was an Indian hater. Even his teammates smiled. And now, trying to explain this to my friends, it occurs to me that, unlike the Villa Carlotta, baseball is a question of neither beauty nor politics, but rather mythology, the collective dream, the old dream of men becoming gods, or at the very least, as they remove their wings, being recognized as men. Another poem that I wrote while I was in Marfa comes from an obituary in the L.A. Times. I've gotten quite a few poems from L.A. Times obituaries. There's one thing the L.A. Times is good for. and this was obituary for a woman who had died in her mid-70s. No one ever expected her to live that long. And her name is Frida Pushnik. And the epigraph is a quotation from the obituary. "Little Frida Pushnik, the armless, legless girl wonder, who spent years as a touring attraction for Ripley's Believe It or Not and Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey." In other words, she was part of what we, much to our shame, used to call freak shows. The obituary also revealed, though, that even though she was limbless, she had an attachment made for her that she held in her mouth. It would turn pages of a book for her, and she could also write with it. So she was actually very, very well read. This is what's called a dramatic monologue. And it is Frida Pushnik who speaks. If I don't get through this poem, nothing will happen. We will just all turn to each other and say, "What a very nice, yet somewhat brief poem." Frida Pushnik. "These are the faces I love. Adrift with wonder, big-eyed as infants and famished for that strangeness in the world they haven't known since childhood. They are monsters of innocence who gladly shoulder the burden of the blessed, the unbroken, the beautiful, the lost. They should be walking on their lovely knees like pilgrims to that shrine in Guadalupe where I failed to draw a crowd. I might even be their weird little saint, though God knows I've wanted everything they've wanted, and more, of course. When we toured Texas, west from San Antonio, those tiny cow towns flung like pearls from the broken necklace of the Rio Grande, I looked out on a near infinity of rangeland and far blue mountains, lone disciples of emptiness, minor gods of that vast and impossibly pure nothing to whom I spoke my little stillborn ritual prayer. I'm not on those posters they paste all over town, those silent orgies of secondary colors, all that purple, blood red, and burnt orange, each one a shrieking anthem to the exotic. Bengal tigers, ubiquitous as alley cats, raw with not inhuman but superhuman beauty. Absurdly buxom dancers clad in gossamer, and spiritual gray elephants, trunks raised like arms to Allah. Franciscan murals of plenitude, animal vitality ripe with the fruit of Eros, the faint blush of sin, and I am not there. Rather, my role is the unadvertised, secret, wholly unexpected thrill you find within, a discovery, irresistible, like sex. So here I am. The crowd leaks in, halting, unsure, a bit like mourners at a funeral, but without the grief. And there is always something interior, damp, and, well, sticky about them. Their cotton candy soul smearing the bad air, funky, bleak, all quite forgettable, except for three. A woman, middle-aged, plain and unwrinkled as her Salvation Army uniform, bland as oatmeal, but with this heavy, leaden sorrow pulling at her eyelids and the corners of her mouth. Front row four times, weeping, weeping constantly, then looking up, lips moving in some silent prayer, I think, and blotting tears with a kind of practiced automatic movement that somehow suggests the sorrow is her own, and I'm her mirror, the little well of suffering from which she drinks. A minister once told me to embrace my sorrow. To hell with that, I said, embrace your own. And then there was that young woman, Arbus, who came and talked brilliantly, set up the shot, at length, hours in fact, then said, I'm very sorry, and just walked away. The way the sunlight drops through the opening at the top, around the center tent pole, like a spotlight cutting through the smutty air, and it fell on him, the third, a boy of maybe 16, hardly grown, sitting in the second row, not too far but not too close, red hair flaring numinous, ears big as hands, gray eyes that nailed themselves to mine. My mother, I remember, looked at me that way, and a smile, not quite a smile. He came twice, and that second time, just before I thanked the crowd, I'm so glad you could come. Please tell your friends. His hand rose, floated really to his chest. It was a wave. The slightest, shyest wave, goodbye, hello, what's the difference anyway? As if he knew me, truly knew me, as if someday he might return. His eyes, his hair, as vivid as the turbans on those elephants, in the posters where I'm not. That day the crowd seemed to slither out, to ooze like reptiles, I thought, sluggish, sleek, gut-hungry for the pleasures of the world, for the prize, the doll from the rifle booth, the girl he gives it to, the winning shot, the magic number, the snow cone dripping, the popcorn dyed with all the colors of the rainbow, the sky it crowns, and whatever, if anything, lies beyond it. The one, perhaps, we're told, enthroned there, who in love or rage or some spasm of inscrutable desire made that teeming, oozing, devouring throng born now into the midway sunlight, that vanished and forever present God of the unborn, to whom I say again my little prayer, let me be one of them. Okay. Well, to return to the little Kansas town where I grew up, summer was different, though you had to be lucky. If you were one of the lucky boys in town during the summertime, you got a job on a combine crew, and you would go up through Nebraska, the Dakotas, clear up into Canada. You would have all kinds of adventures on the way, so you'd be able to come back and brag about it. But the boys who had to stay back in town and endure the summer there would begin to go crazy with boredom. But some would go crazy earlier than others, and thus would provide the entertainment that kept the others sane. And it occurred to me one day that I wanted to write a kind of homage to those guys who did all those crazy things that enabled me to get through the summertime there. So this is called Brazil. And because when you read poems, sometimes things fly over your head that you would otherwise get if you were reading, and I think you would get these if you were reading the poem. But because that's true, I need to explain a couple of things. One of them, if you play the horses, you know that the trifecta is not normally a smart bet unless you have some inside information, in which case, if you win, it pays huge. But of course, you got to hang on to your claim ticket. The other one had to do with a sign, that a neon sign that hung out over the little main street in our town that had Freeman Glass written on it. And I and my fellows decided it would be a valuable and really intelligent thing to do before we graduated from high school to knock the middle letters out of Freeman Glass. Okay. Brazil. This is for Elton Wayne Showalter. Redneck surrealist who drunk one Friday night tried to hold up the local 7-Eleven with a caulking gun. And who, when Melinda Bozell boasted that she would never let a boy touch her down there, said, "Down there, you mean like Brazil?" Oh, Elton Wayne, with your silver-toed turquoise on black boots and Ford Fairlane dragging in a ribbon of sparks its tailpipe down Main Street Saturday nights, you dreamed of Brazil and other verdant lands. But the southern hemisphere remained for all those desert years a vast mirage shimmering on the horizon of what one might call your mind. Following that one ugly night at the snack shack, when drunk again, you peed on your steaming radiator to cool it down, and awoke at the hospital, groin empurpled from electric shock, and your pathetic maleness swollen like a bruised tomato. You dumb bastard. Betting a week's wages on the trifecta at Raton, then in ecstasy tossing the winning ticket into the air and watching it float on an ascending breeze out over the New Mexico landscape forever and beyond. The tears came down, but the spirit rose late on Sunday night on a stepladder, knocking the middle letters from Freeman Glass to announce unlimited sexual opportunities and purple neon. For all your friends driving Kansas Avenue as we did each night, lonely and boredom-racked and hungering for someone like you, Elton Wayne, brilliantly at war in that flat, treeless county against maturity, right thinking, and indeed intelligence in all its bland local guises, so that now reading the announcement in the hometown paper of your late marriage to Melinda Bozell, with a brief honeymoon at the Motel 6 in Junction City, I know that you have finally arrived in Brazil. And the Kansas that surrounds you is an endless sea of possibility, genius, love. Final poem for this evening, and I'm very proud of myself. It looks like I'm right on time here. This is an absolutely true story. And actually, I had there several times, I shouldn't say several, but at least two or three times, when I was writing poems that I tried to quit. And this time I had really successfully quit for a year. But I had a late class and nothing to do up there except write poems. And so I knew this one story that I had been told. I knew I was one of the few people who knew this story. And I thought, well, before I totally quit, I need to write this poem. And it made me start writing poems again. The title of the poem is Body and Soul, and after the old blues ballad. The narrator of the poem is actually hearing this story told by the father of one of his friends, and he thinks the father is telling the story all the wrong way, that he doesn't really understand the story. There's a reference to Okarchi, Oklahoma, which you'll want to put on your summer vacation itinerary. The reference to an Alice Chalmers, which of course is a tractor or combine in this case, is the tractor that marks the outfield. The reference to V-Day, which would be Victory in Europe or Victory in Japan Day, either one. And this is a Sandlot baseball game. It's about 1946. These guys have all come back from the war. Some of them are pretty bitter because they're really good baseball players. They might have had big league careers or at least minor league careers, but they gave their best years to World War II. And they have really low-paying jobs on oil rigs or in zinc mines or whatever. So Sunday is a big day for them. And this would have been the equivalent, I think, of about Class A minor league ball. But it was just sandlot baseball. The other team shows up this Sunday and they're one man short. I also need to, for those who are not big baseball fans, when you're playing a game and you've got a guy on the other team who hits like two or three home runs in a row, there's an easy way to solve that problem. You walk him, okay. Well, there's some other references here, period references to like Chesterfields. Remember those? Yeah. Les Brown, Glenn Miller. Body and soul. Half numb, guzzling bourbon and coke from coffee mugs, our fathers fall in love with their own stories, nuzzling the facts but mauling the truth. And my friend's father begins to lay out with the slow ease of a blues ballad a story about sandlot baseball in Commerce, Oklahoma, decades ago. These were men's teams, grown men, some in their 30s and 40s who worked together in zinc mines or on oil rigs, sweat and khaki and long beers after work, steel guitar music whanging in their ears, little white rent houses to return to where their wives complained about money and broken Kenmores and then said the hell with it and sang Body and Soul in the bathtub, and later that evening with the kids asleep, lay in bed stroking their husband's wrist tattoo and smoking Chesterfields from a fresh pack until everything was okay. Well, you get the idea. Life goes on. The next day is Sunday, another ball game, and the other team shows up one man short. They say, we're one man short, but can we use this boy? He's only 15 years old, and at least he'll make a game. They take a look at the kid, muscular and kind of knowing the way he holds his glove, with the shoulders loose, the thick neck, but then with that boy's face under a clump of angelic blonde hair, and say, oh hell, sure, let's play ball. So it all begins. The men loosening up, joking about the fat catcher's sex life. It's so bad, last night he had to make love to his wife. That sort of thing. Pairing off into little games of catch that heat up into throwing matches, the smack of the fungo bat, lazy jogging into right field, big smiles and arcs of tobacco juice, and the talk that gives a cool, easy feeling to the air, talk among men normally silent, normally brittle, and a little angry with the empty promise of their lives. But they chatter and say, rock and fire, babe, easy out, and go right ahead and pitch to the boy, but nothing fancy, just hard fastballs right around the belt. And the kid takes the first two, but on the third, pops the bat around so quick and sure that they pause a moment before turning around to watch the ball still rising and finally dropping far beyond the abandoned tractor that marks left field. Holy shit. They're pretty quiet watching him around the bases, but then, what the hell? The kid knows how to hit a ball, so what? Let's play some goddamn baseball here. And so it goes. The next time up, the boy gets a look at a very nifty low curve, then a slider, and the next one is the curve again, and he sends it over the Alice Chalmers high and big and sweet. The left fielder just stands there, frozen. As if this isn't enough, the next time up, he bats left-handed. They can't believe it. And the pitcher, a tall, mean-faced man from Okarchee who just doesn't give a shit anyway because his wife ran off 2 years ago, leaving him with three little ones and a rusted-out Dodge with a cracked block, leans in hard, looking at the fat catcher like he was the son of a bitch who ran off with his wife. Leans in and throws something out of the dark green hell of forbidden fastballs. Something that comes in at the knees and then leaps viciously towards the kid's elbow. He swings exactly the way he did right-handed, and they all turn like a chorus line toward deep right field, where the ball loses itself in sagebrush and the sad burnt dust of Dust Bowl, Oklahoma. It is something to see. But why make a long story long? Runs pile up on both sides. The boy comes around five times, and five times the pitcher is cursing both God and his mother. As his chew of tobacco sours into something resembling horse piss, and a ragged and bruised Spalding baseball disappears into the far horizon. Good night, Irene. They have lost the game and some painful side bets, and they have been suckered. And it means nothing to them, though it should to you, when they are told the boy's name is Mickey Mantle. And that's the story, and those are the facts. But the facts are not the truth. I think, though, as I scan the faces of these old men now lost in the innings of their youth, I think I know what the truth of this story is. And I imagine it lying there in the weeds behind that Alice Chalmers, just waiting for the obvious question to be asked. Why? Oh, why in hell didn't they just throw around the kid, walk him, after he hit the third homer? Anybody would have, especially nine men with disappointed wives and dirty socks and diminishing expectations, for whom winning at anything meant everything. Men who knew how to play the game, who had talent, when the other team had nothing except this ringer who without a pitch to hit was meaningless. And they could go home with their little $2 side bets and stride into the house singing, if you've got the money, honey, I've got the time, with a bottle of Southern Comfort under their arms, and grab Dixie or Mayella up and dance across the gray linoleum as if it were V-Day all over again. But they did not. And they did not because they were men. And this was a boy. And they did not because sometimes after making love, after smoking their Chesterfields in the cool silence and listening to the big bands on the radio that sounded so glamorous, so distant, they glanced over at their wives and noticed the lines growing heavier around the eyes and mouth, felt what their wives felt, that Les Brown and Glenn Miller and all those dancing couples, and in fact, all possibility of human gaiety and lightheartedness were as far away and unreachable as Times Square or the Avalon Ballroom. They did not, because of the gray linoleum lying there in the half-dark, the free calendar from the local mortuary that said one day was pretty much like another, the work gloves looped over the doorknob like dead squirrels. And they did not because they had gone through a depression and a war that had left them with the idea that being a man in the eyes of their fathers and everyone else had cost them just too goddamn much to lay it at the feet of a 15-year-old boy. And so they did not walk him and lost, but at least had some ragged remnant of themselves to take back home. But there's one thing more, though it's not a fact. When I see my friend's father staring hard into the bottomless well of home plate as Mantle's fifth homer heads toward Arkansas, I know that this man with the half-orphaned children and worthless Dodge has also encountered for his first and possibly only time the vast gap between talent and genius, has seen as few have in the harsh light of an Oklahoma Sunday the blonde and blue-eyed bringer of truth who will not easily be forgiven. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, here we are. Come once again.
Right. We're here with that two quarts of beer between us.
Well, this is true. And and somewhat older, I think, one of many of those encounters. I guess I'll start with something that seems a fairly obvious question, one your poems always address, but I never, you know, tire of hearing about, you know, growing up. Our experiences were similar, but also vastly different because of the areas. But you grew up in small towns in Oklahoma and Texas and spent your formative years, as it were, in liberal Kansas. And I take it that liberal wasn't exactly liberal.
No. It's widely known as the most inappropriately named town in the United States.
In your poems, a lot of times, I think, you know, what I sense is that you're sort of retroactively looking back, you know, trying to solve the mystery of how a poet, you know, comes out of liberal Kansas. And I just wondered, you know, were there any real... you know, influences there when you grew up that steered you toward literature, particularly toward poetry?
First of all, when poets talk about influences, I think that they typically are not aware of the things that really influence. I think the things that influence you deeply, maybe you somehow don't talk about, and the things that maybe influence you less, you do talk about. I must say that I've really gotten tired of interviews with poets where they're asked that question and they say something like, well, you know, I began reading Rilke at the age of 5. I mean, my first reading, I learned to read at a fairly early. I was reading by the time I was 4, and I learned to read with comic books. They're great, you know, instruments for teaching reading. You got the words with the pictures. But I think maybe... if I do have influences, I think a lot of the influences are prose writers. And the book that had the biggest influence on me ever was a book written by a man that I learned actually lived near Santa Fe, Ernest Seton Thompson, who wrote Biography of a Grizzly. And then later, because the only fiction that my father would read was Hemingway, when I was in high school, I read Hemingway's short stories, and I think it was Hemingway's short stories that really was the bridge by which I crossed over into what you could call literature. But then as far as poetry, well, you know, I have to say what was probably true in your hometown, too. In high school, any expression of interest in poetry was just a great way to get the crap beat out of you. I'm sure if you're a boy, at least. I think the only, because it was sort of a rural high school, I think the only contemporary poet that we read was Robert Frost. And so Frost poems interested me a lot, and there are many of them I didn't understand. And then we read Walt Whitman, and I thought that was cool. And the Beat Movement was making its way to Kansas by about the time I was a junior or senior in high school. So I somewhere got a hold of a copy of Howl, and I thought it was cool for about 2 pages. and I proceeded to write totally in secret some of the worst poems ever conceived by humankind. And then I went off to college, and you know, there was the usual. I was so hungry to get to college that I think all the poets I read had an enormous influence on me, and there were the traditional ones. I mean, Shakespeare and Donne and Milton and Keats and Tennyson and Browning and the rest of them. But more directly to what I think you're asking, I didn't think that I had anything to write about. I thought that poems were just about Grecian urns and unrequited love and nightingales and so forth. So I had no material to write about. And I read some poems by William Stafford, and I read poems by James Wright and by Richard Hugo. And that was really important because they showed me that, in fact, because they wrote about that kind of material, that in fact that was the material, in fact that was the poetry. So that was important to me. And then I think the next big thing was I read a book that you and every other poet knows very well, and that is The Hard Hours by Anthony Hecht, which is, to my mind, one of the great, great books of American poetry. And that was had a huge effect on me. Sometimes people have asked, well, you know, Hecht for you was the most able craftsman of the English language during your lifetime. Why didn't you write like him? And my answer is, well, I would. I guess I would if I could, you know. He was way beyond me, still is way beyond me.
Well, like many critics, I think you're probably a little tired of it too, commented on the importance of place in your poetry, which of course is, you know, virtually all of the poems, you know, that, you know, kind of come to mind are, you know, set in the Midwest or, you know, either there or California, which you've adopted very well into your poetry. But it seems to me that relatively few people have spoken about the importance of time as the way it operates in your poems. And I mean that in two senses. One, the sense of the times in which you grew up, which I think, you know, are very important to a poem like Body and Soul. And also the way that your poems speculate on and handle time moving from present to past, which, you know, could be seen in some of these poems.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of thing you're not really aware of until other people begin to notice it. But I have a long poem, I'm sure the longest poem I'll ever write, about 25 pages long, in Early Occult Memory Systems of the Lower Midwest, in which there's a character named Roy Garcia. He's a kind of a mentor to the boy who is me in the poem. And he's a very well-educated man. He's also a man who believes in the afterlife, and he teaches the boy the memory theater of Giordano Bruno, the great Renaissance scientist as well as scholar and so forth. And he teaches in the memory theater because he says, if you use it, and you remember everything that you ever loved, then you will carry it into the afterlife. And then the book ends with a poem in which the poet is dying, and he's trying to do Giordano Bruno's memory trick that Roy Garcia taught him in order to beat time. And that's when I first became aware that I think I see poetry, and I think I see all art as a way of beating time. I don't like the idea of time passing, and I really don't understand, if there is a God, why this was ever put into the works, you know? I don't like to leave things behind. If you grow up loving people, and then you have to leave them, what the hell is that about, you know? So I think maybe, of course, I wouldn't have been able to articulate this to myself, but sort of falling in love with art, with poetry and painting and so forth, is that I saw it as maybe a way to beat time, to get beyond past, present, and future. There, I had a really great American history professor who would say all kinds of wise things in class, and one day he said something I never forgot, and it always proved true. He said, he was talking about paintings, and he says, you know you're standing in front of a great work of art when it seems more real than you are. And that's because it has that sense of being out of time. You're in time, but it somehow occupies something with, I guess, between diurnal time and eternity. So, that probably is in the poems.
Well, your great poem, Beauty, which I've heard you read on a couple of occasions, and it begins with a vision of Donatello's David, and then moves back and forward in time to memories of the machine shop and a very strange, essentially an anecdote that is, you know, turned into an incredibly compelling narrative in that poem. And that is one of the poems, I think, that brings together not only the whole sense of time, but what you said about, you know, the whole notion about having any kind of aesthetic sense in a small town that you had never heard, you said, I believe, a grown man say the word beautiful, except for perhaps your mother's brother said it once.
I had an uncle, favorite uncle, who was entertaining, and he was unlike my other uncles. I mean, he's from California. But he liked to tap dance and stuff like that, and he had a vocabulary, and he said things other men didn't say. Yeah, and one day my mother had put a lovely centerpiece one Thanksgiving on the table, and he said, he told her that was a lovely centerpiece, and my father got up and left the table. So, the whole concept of beauty wasn't really used, I realize, you know, unless you were referring to a dead deer or a new pickup or something. So when I wrote that poem, although I do have the habit of wanting to bring high culture into, I guess you would say, low culture situations, but in that particular case, I decided I wanted the most risky icon for beauty I could get, and that would have been, of course, Donatello's sculpture of David, which, if you've ever seen, it looks like it must have been sculpted in some 16th century version of West Hollywood. Yeah.
But, you know, there is, I think, what interests me, and of course, in that poem and others as well, that, you know, particularly these machinists, these operators of lathes and other kind of industrial equipment, you know, are sort of consistently seen, if not as artists, as artisans.
Right.
And very skilled craftsmen in your work, and, you know, in some way possess maybe an aesthetic sense that they are totally unaware of.
Absolutely. Yeah, that goes right to the heart of most of what I've written, at least in these four books. I'm kind of hoping the next book will be a little different from that. But yeah, that was one of the really lucky things for me, is I grew up among people who were craftspeople, lathe operators and welders and so forth. And I had a really early sense of craft and things well done. And I think my first aesthetic lesson was from my father. When I was like 4 or 5 years old, we would be walking through the machine shop, and he would point to something, some work some guy had done, and he had this gesture. He would do this, you know, like that, and he'd say, "That's really sloppy work." I can't emphasize how dismissive that wave of the hand was, but he'd say, that's sloppy. And I just knew that was the worst thing you could do. But then he would say, see Al Heidelball over there? He'd say, that's really good work. And I knew that was the best thing you could do. So I grew up with this sense, yeah, of craft as being very, very close, if not the same thing as art. Yeah.
So I take it that you are not in agreement with the many people today who said that we really shouldn't judge works of art on levels and say that this is good and that is not good. Would I be accurate in assuming that you have that reactionary position, which I share?
Yeah, right. You have no idea how much I share that position. No idea at all, yes.
Well, I one of the things, again, that interests me, and you know, you've written very well, you know, poems, some poems about your children, not as many as a lot of poets, but you kind of sense that, you know, there are, you know, there's a family behind there, and, you know, there are certain things that, you know, you want to pass on to them. I'm thinking particularly of a poem called The Decline of Utopian Ideas in the West, that's dedicated to your son, Paul, which is essentially a catalog simply of, you know, sort of bizarre things you remember from your childhood.
Right.
And, you know, and of course the rites of passage, like the rolling cars and, you know, these things that, you know, are so dangerous and horrify us as parents today, but were so important to you. When you think about your own children, do you feel like that they have had, you know, equivalent experiences in growing up, or have they been perhaps, society's changed so much?
Well, they had a very different life from me, but they knew their grandfather, and I told them stories endlessly about the machine shop and the oil fields in the old days, because we did move to Kansas when I was 10, but when I was a child, we were moving from one oil boom town to another. And so they know the stories. But both of my children have a really good appreciation of the arts. Well, actually, my daughter was a professional ballet dancer for the Houston Ballet for 2 years. And my son, who started out in pre-med at a very good college and then made that saddest of all phone calls, where he says, phones and says, you know, I've decided to switch my major from pre-med to philosophy. Yeah. Much gnashing of teeth and rending of garments over that. Yeah. But what could I say, since I had done the same damn thing, so. But anyway, he did, what does a philosophy major do when he graduates? Well, naturally, he went to New York to make comic books, so. But he really saw comic books as a kind of art form, and did pretty well at it for a while. Anyway, the poem you mentioned actually ends with a quotation from the Green Lantern, which to him
that's
the divine comedy of comic books. Is
the poems, I think, have always remained, you know, so memorable to me because of the characters who were in the poems. And of course, we have Travis Doyle and Elton Wayne, Joe Walter.
Yeah, right.
But I would say that probably your most sustained and complex character appears not only in several of your best long poems, but you also have, I don't know how to say it, but, you know, your versions of the poems this character might have written.
Yes, right.
Is Roy Eldridge Garcia.
Right.
And, you know, you mentioned him just briefly, but could you tell us a little bit about this sort of composite figure?
Sure, yeah. He appeared in a short poem in Are the Lathe, and I decided to make him the central part of this long poem called The Blue Buick and Early Occult Memory Systems. And he's a conflation of about three different men who had a huge impact on me. One of them was the foreman of my father's machine shop, and there's an incident which is absolutely factual in the Blue Buick, in which I ask him, you know, I say, Travis, you know, come, you know, he's the only man who ever showed up drunk that you didn't fire. And he said, yes. He says, that's because he's a genius. And he was. He was just a man out of his element. I mean, he worked in a machine shop, and that's fine. But he knew several languages. Anyway, he was one of the people, and then another was a Hispanic fellow that I worked with, who was kind of a mentor to me in the really important ways, like women. And then another was a fellow who was kind of a low-ranking screenwriter who was blacklisted. So those kind of went into... And Roy Garcia has become a kind of a permanent figure for me. And in the next book, there will be more prose poems by Roy Garcia. But he's a nice way that I can write poems that I wouldn't ordinarily write. And I don't know if this means that I'm developing a multiple personality or what. But, yeah, that's who he is.
We all need a few doppelgangers, I think, working for us. I guess you told me today, which surprises me not at all, that your manuscript in progress is titled Usher.
Yes.
And you've also told me, and it's in several of your poems many times, the stories of how you were an actual theater usher in a place like this. I don't think as nice as this, but of the same vintage anyway. Yes. But films have obviously had huge influence on your work, and I think probably Pete and I together, have seen Chinatown more than the total of everybody in this audience having seen that film. It's kind of a great touch. I don't know if we saw it together the first time. I believe we did. We kind of went out and said, oh my God, we've got to go back. But talk a little bit about the movies, culturally in the small towns. You mentioned films all the time, like, not very good films, but films like The Country Girl, and you're saying, this is art.
That's right.
The Bridges of Toko Ree.
Yeah. I could talk about that forever. I won't, but... you see, though, that films were... that's the nearest thing we had in that little town to what you would call art. Not that the little town was any more backward than any other towns in Kansas, but I'd never been in a concert hall before I got to college, certainly never been to an opera, never been to an art museum before I got to college. And so movies were art. Now, I didn't think of them that way until, in fact, I saw The Country Girl. Well, I saw it six times because I was ushering, but it really moves me. It got me in the way that art does. And there's a line in The Blue Buick, which is absolutely true. I was walking home from the theater and thinking about The Country Girl. I don't know how many of you have ever seen that. It has Bing Crosby, and it has a movie star whom I'm still in love with her, as a matter of fact, Grace Kelly. And I was walking home, and I said, that must be what people mean when they talk about art, because I didn't really know what art was. But that's, back in the day when they had ushers in movies, I worked as an usher in the two movie theaters in town, and then later I worked as a movie usher at college. And so I think movies have had a profound effect upon most of the poets of our generation. And I could cite two quick incidents. One thing that you can do with movies is you can steal images from them. And there's a film called, made from the great Carson McCullers novel, Heart is a Lonely Hunter, in which, although in the novel, the man, little man who is a watch repairman, has a homosexual relationship with this other man in the movie, because it was made, in the early 60s? Yeah. They just had to be good friends. But his friend breaks into, his friend is mentally handicapped, and he breaks into a candy store, and they haul him away to the mental hospital, and he's going to be there for the rest of his life. And so his friend, played by Alan Arkin, who is a watch repairman in this little Georgia town, sees him being hauled away in the bus, and he's a deaf mute, and so there's this incredible scene where he's walking down the street, and he starts doing sign language, and he's doing sign language to himself, and you think, well, he's grieving, it's his way of talking to himself, he's grieving, And then the hands start going faster and faster and faster, and you realize the grief is becoming insurmountable, and it reaches a point, he's going so fast, and then suddenly the hands drop to the sides. And there you have it. Small town scene, people walking down the street, and some guy is walking along with his hands straight down beside him, and he is in absolutely unbelievable grief. And I was just blown away by that scene. So I stole it and used it in a poem, which is, you know. I could give you, I said two instances, but I won't go into the other one because it's more or less like that. It's a scene from Tender Mercies. But anyway, I've done that three or four times. Have you ever used and stolen an image from a movie and used it in a poem?
I don't think there are any images in my poetry that weren't stolen from movies. My first book was called The Drive-In, after all.
That's right. Yeah, Sam's father owned drive-ins, so we'll talk about having it nice.
When can we expect the next book? I'm looking forward to it, and I've heard, you know, some of the poems from it already, and, you know, how's your state of production these days?
A fine press book with Frida Pushnik and The Gray Man and a third poem, it's kind of a trilogy, will be out this year from the illustrator Barry Mosier's little press, Penny Royal Press. And then, for the first time in my life, I have a contract with Norton to have a book out with them in 2008, which is only half finished. I never was in that position before, and I'm beginning to have nightmares about it.
Well, may anything that you experience in the next year, at least, that's going to be about it, be grist for your meal, and I know that it will be, because I don't think I've ever known anybody who, you know, certainly can take, as you say, you know, you thought you had nothing to write about in growing up, and really make this incredible transmutation of those materials in your own poems. So, thank you very much, Pete.
Oh, thank you, Sam.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.